Hi, I'm Genevieve Bell, Director of Intel's User Experience Group in the Digital Home.
And we're here in Bed Club in New York. I'm Michael Johnson. We're here to talk about some of the different aspects of how the computer's used, and we're here in Bed because this kind of demonstrates sort of the technology is going a lot of places. Tell me, Genevieve, what your work involves at Intel?
That's a good question, Michael. So I'm actually a cultural anthropologist by training and disposition. I run a small team of researchers and designers, people with backgrounds in anthropology, human factors engineering, interaction design, and really our job and in some ways our challenge is to help keep Intel focused on the fact that the digital home is actually a place where real people live. And so our sort of our big, in some ways, research impulse and our charter has really been to help keep Intel's eyes on those people and their homes. So we've just finished doing a big research study that had us in about 100 homes in 13 different countries around the world, really just trying to get a sense of what people do, what they care about, what technologies they have, and how they make sense of those things, not just as pieces of technology, but as social and cultural artifacts, and even as relationships.
How does that incorporate itself into the rest of Intel? Because it's one thing to gather all the information, quite another to coalesce it into something that's practical and to be used for people on an everyday basis.
That's such a good question, and it's in fact the heart of InThink, in some ways, our biggest challenge. In doing that kind of research is hard work, yes, but it's relatively straightforward work. I think the much bigger challenge has been developing a process that will take us from that kind of rich, nuanced ethnographic data to platform or sub-platform level ingredients. And we've just sort of completed a six-month effort to develop a process to do that inside Intel. And we're really now starting to get to the point where what we can do is take these kind of detailed understandings of people's everyday practice and run them down to what that actually means in terms of technology attributes and requirements. So you can say, okay, we know that people really care about a kind of rich, immersive experience of their digital content, for instance. In fact, people mostly talk about it as things like, I really like to go home and kick off my shoes and kind of escape, right? And that notion of being transported, transformed, removed from the everyday. And I think if you take that as part of what it is the technology has to achieve, it has really interesting implications for acoustic levels, for instance. If you want a device that's going to, you know, play your movies, for instance, and let you have that wonderful thing you can have in the movies where you don't have to be you and you can be hundreds and thousands of miles away or years away. If the device is sitting there making as much noise as a small refrigerator, that's not very satisfying, right? So I think we can start to say, listen, we know that people want to have these rich, immersive experiences. So there's some things we can start to say about the technology that we didn't have to say when they were in the office, when, you know, there was lots of other white noise around. So we can start to think about acoustic levels, heat dissipation levels, even form factors. If you've got something sitting in your living room or somewhere else you're watching content, you probably don't want an entire array of blinking LED lights distracting you. So, you know, we can start to think about what does a good form factor look like. So really, you know, if you start to think about what it is consumers care about and how they're already living their lives, it actually leads you to some quite kind of specific technology decisions.
And that's going to be different from country to country. I mean, I know that in looking at some of like Motorola's phones like the Ming and some of the other ones that have had a really kind of different form factor for China and also the practical use of something that might be used in India, it's very different. It's very different how people are going to approach these things.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's most fascinating about my job and that I love about it best in some ways is that kind of incredible, rich set of cultural differences. So, I mean, you're right. Not only are there the kind of physical practicalities of daily life, so what your home looks like, how big it is, how it's provisioned in terms of infrastructure are going to be very different from place to place. I mean, you know, it's certainly true that American homes are arguably the biggest homes in the world, right? I mean, we're talking about upwards of 2,300 to 2,700 square feet on average, freestanding dwellings for the most part, although not true in New York City, but certainly true in most other parts of the U.S. In contrast that to Western Europe, where the average home is about 1,000 square feet and is likely to be attached to other buildings, or Asia, where the average home starts to get, you know, under 800 square feet and is in a multi-story, high-density dwelling, those have really different implications for rolling out infrastructure. For instance, much easier to connect up an apartment complex to a high-speed data connectivity than it is to connect up a suburb. And, you know, if your home's only 800 square feet, you make very different decisions about what kind of technology is in it than if it's 2,700 square feet. So I think some of just the materiality of daily life comes into play there, but also the fact that not only are those homes different, but the ways people think about them, the things they care about, who lives in those homes, what kind of social relationships we're talking about, how people imagine things like privacy, trust, security are all really different.
Well, I know something that came up in the study was that I think it was in Italy or Spain where people actually are, you know, I think it was young girls were sharing their phones.
Oh,
they're
absolutely.
Passing phones yep. around now. That would be unheard of in the United States. Totally
not,
unheard of.
You're not giving your phone to your best friend for a day, Michael?
Well, actually, I have, but I'm a little bit different. So.
No, I think it's actually, we were really surprised, but in some ways not, right? It was quite typical to have teenage girls in particular, but not the only ones, sharing phones that way. So giving your phone over to your best friend for a day was this act of real trust, right? But also a very different way of imagining what the technology is like. Similarly, you know, young people in a number of those countries were saving all of their text messages to their mobile phones, so their mobile phones were starting to act a little bit more like diaries. But I think, you know, some of our ideas that are really common in certain parts of the US, sort of mainstream US, of, you know, I own that piece of gear and it's mine and I'm not giving it to someone else, just don't hold true elsewhere. I mean, I've spent time in households where there were fewer phones than there were people, and it was kind of typical that you just took whatever phone was charged and had money and headed out for the day and, you know, deal with the consequences. So a very different pattern of ownership and use.
So where do you imagine things are going to be? I mean, you've had a chance to sort of look at a very wide swath of use of mobile devices and technology. Where do you think that this will go next? Say, we'll start with, say, with just the United States.
Wow, hard question, right? But I think in some ways for me, it's less about predicting the future than it is about thinking about what do people care about now and how do we make sure that we're developing the technology that responds to that. So, I mean, it's clear looking around the room that you and I are in right now that there's a remarkable richness of digital content already available. But I think one of the challenges for those of us who produce technology is to keep it simple. I mean, think about the television, the history of the television, how wonderful televisions are as a kind of user experience in some ways. They're incredibly simple. You don't need to understand the technology that's operating behind them to be successful. You know, your television doesn't ask you if it wants to, you know, you to cache content at this rate or that rate. It doesn't ask you to defrag it. You know, there's a whole lot of things that televisions don't do to you as a consumer, and I think one of the challenges for us who are producing the technology is to help keep it that simple. So I think, you know, one of the things that we will see in the future is, I mean, to my mind at least, is increased focus on intuitive user interfaces, on keeping things simple, on reliability, on robustness. I think it's clear, you know, that you can see stuff is already going to being more and more portable, taking my stuff with me. But that's not true everywhere. I mean, Korea is an interesting example of that, right? A market that's got incredibly kind of high bandwidth connectivity, a lot of deployment of technology, but it's also a place where kind of recently traditional things like, say, iPod and iTunes haven't succeeded. Because why do you need to carry around a hard drive with you when you can download content on these really fat pipes?
It's a completely different model from here. I think here
absolutely.
It tends to be based more on business competition, and there it's more about service delivery.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's also about, you know, American notions of the individual and individual ownership, which don't always hold everywhere else. So I think, you know, for me, it's as interesting to think about what are the challenges we're going to have to overcome as we move forward. And I think one of them is around this notion of reliability and robustness. Another one is around, you know, creating technologies that are open to very different sorts of business models. I think increasingly there's going to be a lot more attention paid to things like power. And by that I mean power in the old-fashioned sense, not in the MIPS per watt sense, but in the electricity that comes out of a wall sense. I mean, you know, for those of us who've spent time in the U.S. over the last couple of years, we know that the price of electricity has gone up. The price of other energy forms are certainly increasing. We know in other parts of the world that electricity is just not reliable, right? You can't guarantee you're going to have power 24 hours a day, but these are also places where new technologies are selling. So I think the challenge increasingly becomes to pay attention to creating technologies that have low power drains, that dissipate small amounts of heat, that have longer battery life, so that, you know, energy in that sense becomes a more interesting and critical issue. I mean, the equivalent of, you know, how do we think about green technology? How do we think about sustainability? I mean, all of those issues come into play for me, and I think, you know, they become these really big challenges for the tech industry, and, you know, I like a good challenge.
Genevieve Bell, it's been great talking with you, with the Intel Users Group, and I know you've been called the chief anthropologist, but I won't call you that.
Thank you so much, and I won't tell anyone we were in bed together again.
All right. Thanks, Genevieve, for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Michael.